Chapter 59. The Rhineland Republic. Are the Rhinelanders Celtic, like us? Asked Clemenceau. I am not so sure, but there is no harm in saying it. But don't ask me what are the definitive characteristics of a Celt. He was ignorant of ethnology and of many other branches of knowledge. He was also a fanatically anti-clerical Freemason, who hated the Rhineland for its strong Catholic tradition. He had extracted the maximum concessions from Lloyd George and Wilson through dogged perseverance. He was going to impose his anti-clericalism on the Rhineland regardless of the consequences, but now he knew he had reached the limit. To demand more would have been the last straw. He thought there were more subtle and diplomatic ways to control the Rhineland than to create an independent state. He knew as well that the Rhinelanders were not longing to be under the control of his government. Meanwhile, Clemenceau had fallen out with Poincaré, the titular head of the French Republic, as well as Marshal Foch, the head of the French army. Both believed Clemenceau either too close to the British point of view or simply too soft on the Rhineland issue. Poincaré and Foch had been brought up on the myth of the lost Rhineland provinces. During the Versailles conference, they openly sniped at Clemenceau's policy and decisions. There were also the activities of General Mangin, commanding officer of the French troops stationed in the Rhineland. He conducted his own policy for the creation of an independent state, sponsoring meetings of prominent Rhinelanders in Landau and Cologne. In April 1919, Mangin had convinced a former Rhineland magistrate named Dorton to accept financial help in exchange for Rhenish separatism. Later on May 17, Mangin met with two Rhineland deputies, Castert and Kuckhoff, and asked them to join his separatist efforts. The pair immediately rushed to Berlin to report the meeting to Chancellor Scheidemann, who was outraged at such blatant interference in the political affairs of Germany. This intervention would assume serious proportions. Wilson had also been informed of separatist machinations not only in the territory occupied by Mangin but also in the American zone. He sent Clemenceau the official report from the American general in charge. This morning, General Mangin, commander of the French army in Mainz, sent one of his staff colonels to the headquarters of General Liggett, Koblenz, to ask what would be our attitude concerning a political revolution on the left bank of the Rhine for the purpose of establishing a free Rhineland Republic, independent from Germany. He assured us he had some 50 delegates ready to move into the American sector to start the revolution. Although he did not specify who the delegates were, it appeared they were French. Wilson added to the report, "General Liggett has refused, and rightly so, to take this proposition into consideration. I totally endorse his decision. He had been given instructions to prevent political agitators from entering our sector, regardless of who gave the orders." Clemenceau, page 181. Clemenceau was stunned. These separatist maneuvers had been conducted behind his back. He immediately dispatched his own investigators to the Rhineland. They quickly confirmed that the incredible had happened. Mangin had even informed Liggett he had no right to prevent the people of the Rhineland from exercising their will. Similar notices were conveyed to General Michel of Belgium and General Robertson of Great Britain. Lloyd George confronted Clemenceau in the middle of the peace conference. "Right now your generals are working at creating a Rhineland Republic." While Clemenceau awaited the full results of his investigations, he learned that Mangin's man, former magistrate Dorton, had on June 1, 1919 proclaimed the Rhineland a republic and formed a government with himself as president. Dorton was backed by not only Mangin and Foch, but by President Poincaré himself. "The president," wrote Clemenceau, "was a discreet but resolute partisan of French annexation of the Rhineland, even if it was called something else." Mangin immediately asked Poincaré to receive Dorton in Paris so that he could express the wishes of 12 million Rhinelanders. Suddenly the number of Rhinelanders had jumped from 7 to 12 million. Poincaré then put pressure on Clemenceau and the Allies. "I suppose the general would not ask me this if the movement were not serious. And if it is serious, I hope the Allies will not force us to suppress it. This movement should in no way shock President Wilson." He then advised Clemenceau, "It would be unfortunate that we should find ourselves against this attempt at independence. Clemenceau felt his authority was at stake and took swift measures to demote Mangin and neutralize Poincaré. The Rhineland Republic was thus nipped in the bud, but Poincaré would keep the issue alive in the French Chamber of Deputies. In such places as Trier and the Palatinate there is a strong call for independence, and in other towns the movement is growing. We can expect sooner or later some changes in the political framework of the occupied territories. Clemenceau, page 191. The changes would come, but not as Poincaré anticipated. On February 12, 1924, some 40 separatists met in the town of Pirmasens in the Palatinate. The gathering took place in a government building, an act which infuriated the townspeople. A crowd massed outside and demanded the separatists leave the premises. When they refused, the crowd doused the walls with gasoline and set the building afire. All the separatists were burnt alive. Massive sabotage prevented the French troops from coming to their rescue. Communications were cut, trains stopped running, roads were blocked. By the time the French arrived, all they found were the charred and massacred bodies of the separatists. Some 15,000 people were crowding the streets. They had assisted in this massacre and were applauding it. Le Temps, February 24, 1924. The violence was a portent of the simmering rage Germans felt towards their occupiers.